you know, pretty much a five-sided box with the exposure, of course, facing away from the house. So I doubt very much a whole lot of radiation is going to go from the back of the meter through the house. Because, you do have the meter socket, the pan, and it's pretty stout. It's, you know, the conductivity between all the sides is there because we're required to do, heavy bonding and whatnot. So I don't see it coming through the wall, you know, in any heavy fashion. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, let me jump in here for a second, Steve. If you actually did a electromagnetic interference test with that sheet of metal there and not there at VHF frequencies, you'd be amazed how few number of dB of shielding you get. To your eye, you've got this metallic object directly in line between you and the sensing circuit, and you think that you're safe. That RF energy crawls around that thing like crazy if it's not a six-sided box. KD2, HUC, Steve, go ahead, KQRW, read for the beep.
Dick, when it comes to things RF, I'll take your word for it. The other thing I had to add is somebody wrote a nice question and answer at a website that we all love and trust, the good old ARRL. If you go to www.arrl.org/smartmeters, somebody did a relatively in-depth analysis. Seems that these things are running on 902 megahertz or 2.4 gigahertz. The FCC rules are mentioned and so on. There's a whole lot of good reading here. So, as amateurs, go to the ARRL and check out the smart meter page. KD2HUC, back to net.
In the case of American Radio Relay League, you stand a much better chance. Those guys are a little bit closer to being scientists. You're going to be finding some good references. There's going to be some traceability to the Bureau, if you know what I mean. Larry is next. WB2CQT. Go right ahead, Larry. You got one of those meters at your house? K2RIW. My name is Dick.
No, I live in an apartment, but I did look into this, and you're not going to believe what I'm going to say. First of all, the RF danger thing I'm not going to speak about. But what they do is they communicate from one to the other down the block when the time is necessary. And I guess the last house on the block sends the information to the electric company. So what I saw was a German engineering school did a study on these things. Let me drop it for a second. And they were able to communicate with the smart meter themselves. They set up an RF and a computer, and they could interrogate the meter and see what it's putting out and read the information from the meter on their computer. And this is the part you're not going to believe. They showed a demonstration where a house with a television on, without other devices drawing current at the time, they were able to tell what channel that TV was tuned to by what the electric meter was putting out. As the picture and things changed on the screen, they were able to match it up and figure out what channel that TV was set to. Over.
Yeah, that's pretty crafty. As your modern-day television set, particularly the solid-state ones, go between a black screen and a white screen and everything in between, the total amount of current for that number of milliseconds that the television set draws changes. So if you can recognize a small amount of delta to your current decrease and increase as a function of what picture channel 7 is sending right now versus channel 13, there's a chance that they can find a correlation and say, yeah, the current drain is following this particular profile of that particular television program, so most likely they're watching that program at this time. That's possible. Craziness. So privacy issues. We got privacy issues going on here. Okay, I think we've covered enough of this one tonight. But when it comes to RF energy that can do you harm, 99% of all the things that you think can do you harm with RF cannot do it. Once you get down to the real numbers, you go to the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, used to be called the Bureau of Standards, and the Bureau of Radiological Health, and all of these other organizations that have intermeshing standards. And there's a similar set of organizations through Europe and Asia and whatever, and they all hang together as far as it really comes down to milliwatts per square centimeter of power flux density of RF energy at what frequency. I mean, at VHF frequencies, the RF energy striking your body, a high percentage of it gets absorbed and turned into heat. Let me drop them. At HF and lower frequencies, the majority of the energy flows right through you and does nothing. You're transparent to it. The frequencies up at 1,500 megacycles and above, 20% of it is absorbed and 80% of it is reflected off your skin. So the so-called microwave frequencies that everybody thinks is dangerous and it means cancer, pound for down microwave frequencies are 5 times safer than VHF. 30 to 300 megacycles is a region where the body is a very good dummy load. And what does the RF energy do? Is it affecting your nervous system and changing the way your brain works and the way your memory works? Not a chance. It gets absorbed and turned into heat. And the amount of heat, the milliwatts per square centimeter that you're allowed to be exposed to, probably in the worst case, can create a couple of tenths of a degree of temperature increase of the nearby tissue of your body. And can that really do you damage? You can get 10 times that amount of change in heat when you expose yourself to the sun, when you're in your bathing suit on your sun blanket in the backyard, if you know what I mean, getting your sun exposure, or at the beach. So highly misunderstood. The word microwave and the word cancer, people relate the two. And the word radiation, it's really the word radiation. Let me drop it. The big mistake is we should have called radio circuits. What they do is emit radio waves. They do signaling and radio emitting. They do not send out radiation. Radiation is a good word. The signal does come out of an antenna and essentially goes in all directions most of the time. And that was a perfectly good word until World War II came along and we had nuclear radiation. And there's a huge difference between nuclear radiation, which is ionizing, and RF radiation, which is not. The individual photons of nuclear radiation are capable of doing cellular damage and possibly creating a cancer in a high exposure situation. RF energy, there's too little energy per corpuscle, I could call it, per photon, with one exception. There's a crazy story that probably is not true, but somebody supposedly took their miniature dog, their little chihuahua, and wanted to dry them off after giving them a bath and put them into a microwave oven. Well, inside that microwave oven, you got 750 watts of RF energy bouncing around. Now, there, by pure heating, you can do damage. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a crazy story, not true. First of all, most microwave ovens are not big enough to hold the dog. And even if you could, yes, you could do a lot of damage in that one situation. But you're talking about 700 watts of concentrated energy in a chamber where all the energy cannot leave. It bounces off the walls and comes back, and the only thing that can absorb it is the animal or the food that's in that microwave oven. Now, that's a possible dangerous thing. On the outside of the microwave oven, which is so well shielded, not a problem. Again, all of these concepts, all these individual characteristics are highly misunderstood, and there's loads and loads of articles. You can easily find articles telling you that, let me drop it. You should never use your microwave oven when the kids are in the house, and never use your cell phone when kids are in the house, because the RF exposure is going to be damaging them. Pure hogwash. Okay, we can always come back to this one. This is a very good subject, radio frequency biohazard. We're going to go over to the list of people who did sign in with other subjects. Rich and 2EO, what was your subject? And try to keep it a little bit brief tonight. We're running a little bit late. And 2EO, K2RIW, try to be brief about Rich. Okay, Joe, WA2RYY. Are you there, Joe? WA2RYY, K2RIW. Hello, anybody? Hey, did I put all you guys to sleep? One last call. Is there anybody who signed into the list for questions and answers and comments on the TechNet that I didn't go to? Give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW.
KD2FIU, Dick, real quick.
Go ahead, George, real quick.
Yeah, Element 2 and Element 3, technician in general, licensing textbooks will give general and specific information on exposure limits. And it's a good background for people to understand before they jump on reading what's on the internet and stuff like that, because it's there. It's telling you a number of feet and what frequencies and the popular stability and all of that stuff and how it's being radiated. General and specific is in Section 10 of each of Element 2 and Element 3 licensing textbooks.
Good information. Nice reference. Thank you, George. Okay, time to go over to the science talk.
NY2H.
Go ahead, NY2H, K2RIW.
All right, just a carryover from last week. There was a question as to the status of the Limoss 1.2 gig repeater. It is definitely off the air. It's a repair facility. So, be off until further notice.
Okay, so it's in a repair facility. I hope the repair facility is in that great town of Hempstead. Okay, probably no guess as to when it might be operational, but that's not a big problem. The total number of people who have 1,200 megacycle equipment, handy talkies or base stations or a mobile rig, the total number of people in the metro area, I think you could count them on one hand. So there's no real mad rush to get that back on the air because a whole lot of people are sitting there angry and protesting with signs out in front of the building. Isn't that true, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW.
Yeah, I haven't seen any protesters yet, so we're good.
Okay. From what I hear, you're doing a good job. Not going to be any protesting. Okay, yeah. Roy. That's Roy, AC2GS. I think if I know you, you've got some nice puzzle for us. And I did a tiny bit of research on that one, so I'm cheating, so I'm not going to be answering right away. AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it, Roy.
Okay, hello, Dick. Are you able to hear me? I'm kind of kludging this stuff together on low power, so do I have full quieting?
On the repeater, you got full quieting, and you're coming close to giving me full quieting on the input. So you're putting out a lot more power than you think you are. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. I have my IC7100 dialed down to 5% power, so that's a good thing. Anyway, as per always, if anyone has any mailbag questions for Dick and can't get on the net, or if they have any topics they would like me to cover, questions they would like me to answer or try to answer, or want to refute anything that I said, that's fine. The email address is, as always, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And of course, after I finish with this, any of the stories that I mention, I will give links to. And the link page, as always, is roy.ac2gs.com. So let me drop for a second, and I'll give you guys a little puzzle.
WB2GX, sir.
Yes, Rich.
The quality of your voice has changed so much, I am prompted to ask if you're under the weather tonight.
He sounds good to me, although a little bit different. So have you changed that microphone or the audio circuit? Roy, go ahead.
Dick, I've changed the entire radio. It's a different microphone. It's a different radio. My Flex 6700 has become bricked by a piece of firmware that it didn't like. I have it taken apart at my work table, and tomorrow, hopefully, when the company mails me a copy-protected micro SD card with the proper codes in it, I will slip it in, put everything back together, and have my 6700 again. So everything's different tonight.
You sound different, but you sound good to me. It's a nice, clear voice. The person who just mentioned that he's different, he's easy to interpret, in my opinion. Over to you, that person, go ahead.
No further comment. Continue, WB2 GXM.
Thank you, GXM. You got it, Roy.
Okay, Rich, hopefully I'll be back with my regular voice and everything after the holidays, but we'll get to that later. Anyway, my first question for the audience, DNA. DNA is a fascinating subject, and I have a little spiel about DNA, but just to warm everyone up, I have two questions. Number one question is, do all living things possess DNA?
Let me modify that. When you say living things, do you include living things that are capable of reproduction? That's something that lives once and dies. Is that particular plant or animal capable of creating an offspring? Is that what you mean by living? Or maybe you are more general with your word living, just something that for a period of time consumes food and does something, but then dies without reproducing. So are you including the possibility of reproduction, now, Roy? Go ahead.
Okay, as always, Dick, you're getting ahead of this, which is great. We're describing living things the way most biologists tend to, that they have cells, that they're able to reproduce, that they can absorb and utilize energy, and that they can respond to their environment. But we'll get into the messy details later on in this little puzzle.
Jackson.
Yes, Rich.
I believe there are certain living organisms which only contain RNA.
Okay, so we have one vote for some organisms that have RNA. Anyone else with any answers to this little puzzle?
BDH.
Yes, John.
I would say yes, with the exception of viruses.
Okay, very good, John. Anyone else with any comments, answers, or questions that this puzzle elicits?
KB2 GSM. Question is the organism required to reproduce by itself? That is to say, without the aid of another organism?
Well, I leave it up to you. If that's how you want to go, then that's as long as it fits the other criteria for a living organism. It can, like malaria does, be a parasitic device that gets absorbed into cells and such. But if you think that there are parasites, cellular parasites that don't have DNA and either have nothing or something else, yes, that's an option to go for.
Locally, if there's no host organism, you need DNA.
Yeah, I'm going to guess here, Roy, that a virus, in many cases, uses RNA, and it's using the mechanism of some other thing, like a cell, in order to carry on its life cycle. All by itself, it can't do it. But I think most things with DNA can independently live and reproduce. Those are some guesses on my part. And correct me on that, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
No, Dick, you're right on. The bottom line is, that any cellular organism that's considered alive has functional DNA. There are organisms that, as I think it was Rich mentioned, that have RNA. Those are viruses, and they kind of are somewhere in the middle between living and not living, because they don't really do a lot. They're just little packages of either DNA or RNA that inject themselves into a living cell and then use the cell's mechanisms to replicate themselves. So the shorter the long answer is that there is no living organism that functions without DNA. My second little puzzle on this subject is, you know, we all know that we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Now, if you were somehow to take one of those chromosomes out, and there are pairs of chromosomes, and each of the pair is actually a single molecule of the DNA. So if you took it out and could tease it, stretch it out, untangle it, I was wondering if anyone had an idea of how long a single chromosome's worth of DNA, that single molecule, would measure approximately. And feel free to use whatever units you're comfortable with.
I'm going to give you a little bit of a hint. Go to the right website. They tell you that if you took a piece of string and you hold one end of the string in your left hand and you twist the right-hand side of the string, assume the string is relatively long, you'll eventually make some coils. Keep twisting and you'll stop making a coil of a coil. Keep twisting, you'll make a coil of a coil of a coil, and so on. I am told that the DNA is a coil of a coil of a coil, five times coil of a coil. If you ever looked under a microscope at an old the filament of a incandescent bulb, it used to be a coil of a coil, if you know what I mean, of tungsten. So it's a very complicated structure, but if you stretched it all out, you'd get an amazing number. And I'll hold off and let people make a guess on that one. The total length of the coils of the coils and the width of the coils of the coil is a very small number. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
QHUC with a guess.
Yes, HUC.
This is one of the few things I remember from high school. I remember them saying that if you uncoiled DNA, it would be the relative height of a man. So I'm going to say somewhere between 5 and 6 feet.
Okay. Anyone else with any suggested length of a single chromosome of DNA in the human body?
When people are finished guessing, I'm going to give you another piece of this puzzle, Roy, that maybe you didn't run across and maybe I did. You got it right.
Okay, very well, Dick. I look forward to it. Anyone else with any suggested lengths? It could be in microns, it could be in millimeters, it could be in inches, it could be in feet, yards, or miles. I leave it up to you. But anyone else have any other ideas of how long a single chromosome in the human body, if you could stretch out the nucleotide sequences to as straight as humanly possible, how long that single molecule in your body that you have 23 pairs of in almost every cell is?
By the way, Roy, the individual steps of the ladder of DNA, they come in pairs. Each individual step, the left side and the right hand side of the step, has these two globular objects that are usually shown in the representation. So two globular objects on one particular step. What's the word that's used to describe those?
They're called nitrogenous bases. They amount to adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine.
And I think there's something like 3 billion of those steps of that ladder. Ain't that amazing?
Well, it takes a lot of codes to blueprint a human being, and plus, most likely, there's a lot of random old DNA that isn't causing any problems, so it just follows along the road of the cells. So it's up to interpretation. When they did the genome study, how much DNA was really coding for specific things and how many was just detritus or a kind of a pseudo-random number generator that cells need to use occasionally.
I guess you could call that inert sections of the code.
Yeah, inert or nonsense sequences, there's been a lot of terms for it, although over time people have found that some things initially thought to be nonsense actually served a non-replicating process. They were kind of a bookmark in areas of the chromosome that control proteins and such could latch onto and trigger events.
So let's see if you've got everybody finished with their guesses, Roy.
Okay, one more time, guys. Any number would be fine. I just want to add that approximately, if you sort of do the math of how many base pairs there are in all the chromosomes divided by 46, it comes out to approximately 174 million base pairs in each average chromosome.
So if you took one human cell, the particular reference I went to claimed that one human cell, you take that coil over coil over coil five times in a row, stretch it all out of all of those base pairs, that it's approximately 2 meters long, which is a little bit less than the height of a human being, which is what Steve was saying. 2 meters long is the amount of DNA in one human cell of your body. Now you take all of the cells of your body and add that all together. That length supposedly is twice the distance across the Milky Way galaxy. That's what this particular reference said, though, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW. Boy, there's a lot of stuff in my body.
Yes, Dick, but it's very, very, very skinny. So what you and the other gentleman, HUC, was describing was the totality of all 46 chromosomes. So, you know, ultimately, you have to divide that by 46. The source that I've read suggests that the average chromosome would be teased out at approximately 2 inches in length.
For a particular chromosome, but aren't all 46 chromosomes contained in each individual living cell of your body? So we thought you were asking the total length of the DNA in a human cell, Roy, go ahead.
Well, I kept on saying one chromosome, which is not a cell. It's you have 46 chromosomes in each nucleus of each cell, except, of course, for some that don't have any nucleus.
Why does that company call itself 23andMe as opposed to 46andMe? Go ahead.
I guess it sounds better. It's 23 pairs, so you can either think of it as 23 pairs or a total of 46. There's actually 22 pairs. 22 non-sexual chromosomes are approximately identical. In the case of X and Y's, though, there's a definite size disparity. The female X chromosome is significantly larger than the male Y chromosome. When guys break it in half, you know, they'll either give an X chromosome in their sperm and they get a daughter, or they get give a Y chromosome and they get a son. So that's the only pair that are very, very unequal. Otherwise, all the other 22 pairs, you couldn't tell the difference. They're about the same exact amount of base pairs.
Now, up to now, we're talking about the length when it's stretched out. It's either roughly 2 meters for the whole 46 pairs, or 2 meters divided by 46 if you want to talk about, let's see, 2 meters would be 200 centimeters divided by 46. We're talking about a few centimeters here for one particular pair. That's the length of this very skinny thing that you've completely stretched out. But the width of that very skinny thing is something in the vicinity of 1 nanometer or something like that. Isn't that true, Roy? Very small distance. Over to you.
Yeah, it's very small. You have to consider the fact that really what you're talking about is probably the width of 6 atoms, which are very small things, because all you have is basically deoxyribonucleic acid is a double-stranded helix. It contains base pairs, the adenosine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. It has a little phosphate subgroup, and it has a sugar subgroup. So it's not a lot of atoms wide. It's just that it's polymerized and chained together with millions of unique base pairs that code for protein synthesis and regulation.
My goodness, that is a complicated system. And so a person who has a religious background can easily say something that complicated couldn't have happened automatically. A religious person would say that, a spiritualistic person. A secular person will say, yeah, it's very complicated, but it took a good fraction of a billion years to get here. That for the first billion years or so of the Earth, we only had very simple moth-like things living on the Earth. Before we got more complicated animals, it took a long time for all this to come together. So you've got evidence either way, whether you want to be spiritual or secular. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
WS2N question.
Yes, Paul.
When they talk about pilots flying in an airplane, they're going to get zapped with a couple of cosmic rays, or astronauts more often because they're above the atmosphere. And the story is that these cosmic rays hit the DNA. Is that what they're talking about? This cosmic ray is going to hit this tiny thin thing that's 6 atoms thick, and then that's going to create a mutation, and then people wind up with cancer. Or you know, is that the story, or is that, you know, a vague story that they come up with? So scared of what's out of people to go on airplanes.
Not necessarily. I mean, this isn't really target practice. You have to kind of keep in mind that it's crunched up and bunched up. If all 46 of them in every single nucleus of every single cell of your body, so is it definite? If you shoot a photon into a person, will it definitely hit the nucleus with the DNA? Probably not. Probably only 1 out of 1,000 or 1 out of 10,000 times. But if you're in an environment where you're exposed to 10,000 high-energy photons, that can get a little dicey after a while.
Okay, but I wasn't saying photons. I was talking about, you know, these cosmic rays that you know, they blame it on the cosmic rays.
Well, it depends. Cosmic rays, unfortunately, is not the greatest term known to mankind. Among high-energy electrons which are beta particles, and high-velocity helium nuclei, which are alpha particles, you have gamma particles, which are electromagnetic radiation at a very high energy where anything it touches will ionize. So ultimately, that's probably, for the most part, what upsets a lot of people, because gamma rays are very difficult to shield. Alpha rays are relatively easy, you know, because of their massive and their charged, and beta radiation a little bit someplace in the middle. So the really nasty things that people particularly don't like is the gamma radiation. You know, we all are exposed to ionizing radiation to one degree or another. UV light is an ionizing radiation, and the sun pours it down on us. So there's always that chance. It's real. It's not definite. If you fly around and expose yourself to a little bit more cosmic rays, the statistical chances that you increase your risk of cancer might be in the thousandths of a percent, where, you know, random occurrences, you know, how many bananas you eat, kind of makes that rather moot.
Okay, it's amazing, though, that they figured out that something, anyway, is hitting these almost impossible small objects, causing mutations, leading to all kinds of problems. Just the idea of trying to figure that out. Well, okay. Back to you, Roy. Just listening.
As energetic as a Nolan Ryan fastball, the showers of particles that result is rather amazing.
Yes, nature is quite amazing, and unfortunately, Paul, it became self-evident that radiation gives you cancer. Madame Curie died of cancer. A lot of the early pioneers in radioactive materials died of cancer. Unfortunately, it was more happenstance than it was experimental theories.
Oh, okay. So the proving of these little things getting hit by something came later. I got it. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. Okay. I don't know. Let me run through my little spiel that I wrote for you guys. Maybe you'll find it elicits more questions. But I'll give it a read and tell me if you have any further questions. Let me drop and I'll read my little bit on DNA. Okay, DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acids, are the largest molecules in the human body, as we mentioned before. About 8 billion base pairs across 23 pairs of chromosomes. As I mentioned, they're 2 inches long approximately. That's an average. It's a double-stranded helix, like a very tall, twisted ladder, someone once described, whose structure was discovered by Francis Crick, Watson, James Watson, Maurice Wilkins, all of whom won a Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1962. The other valuable researcher involved was Rosalind Franklin, who unfortunately died of ovarian cancer, which might have been caused by her work in her X-ray crystallography studies. The DNA made up a very long string of sugar groups, as I mentioned, phosphate groups and nitrogen groups. DNA has been called the blueprint of the cell, since most structures put together based on groups of 3 consecutive base pair coding for specific amino acids that are then linked together by way of 3 types of RNA. One is a messenger RNA that forms complementary copies of the DNA base pairs. Transfer RNA, which brings amino acids to the ribosomes, and ribosomal RNA, along with some ribosomal proteins that do the linking of each amino acid for its proper sequence. Most living cells possess DNA, especially sperm cells, which contain little else. But as always, there are exceptions to the rule. Human red blood cells, as they mature, lose their nuclei, and with it goes their DNA. Let me drop for a sec. But for the most part, if it is properly alive, it has DNA somewhere inside each cell. This is not necessarily true of viruses, which are not exactly alive based on the following definition that I mentioned before. Living organisms have cells, are able to reproduce, can absorb and utilize energy, and respond to their environment. Viruses are dependent upon their host that they invade to accomplish most of these ends, so they're not quite alive. They do, though, need to provide their own genetic blueprint so that the invaded cell can make working copies of the invading virus spread. In this case, viruses do not always use DNA to accomplish this. Some viruses contain no trace of DNA. Instead, they keep their coded plans on copies of the other kinds of nucleic acid, which living organisms also make great use out of RNA. There are even more bizarre, less alive infectious things called prions. They're malformed protein molecules that can be absorbed into the body and act as direct templates for the malformation of our own proteins. And mad-cow disease is transmitted by such prions. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is, as always, AC2GS.
Roy, those three different kinds of DNA you talked about, are they different sections of that 2-inch long string? Where do those three sections hang out, Roy? Go ahead.
No, Dick, there's only one type of DNA. There's three types of RNA. The body, especially human body, but just about every body, every cell sort of has the same mechanism. It's rather amazing, most likely at the very beginning of what we call a complex single-celled organism, came up with this idea, and it was so good that it hasn't been changed in a billion years. But the DNA is what's in the chromosome. There is a molecule that's very similar to DNA, but instead of being deoxyribose, a deoxygenated sugar group, it's a regular sugar group that hasn't been deoxygenated. So it's called RNA, ribonucleic acid. There are three types of RNA. There's messenger RNA, which is the way that the information gets transferred. What happens is the DNA uncoils, the base pairs uncouple, so they expose their base pairs that are complementary to each other. Adenosine and can only bind with thymine. Thymine can only bind with adenosine. So it unpairs, it leaves the nitrogenous bases out in space, and messenger RNA comes, binds to the base pairs, and produces a long strip of messenger RNA with the complementary code from that DNA. It then gets shuttled over to some organelle called a ribosome that produces proteins. And there are types of RNA that grab the amino acids in the cell and bring them to that place. And there's other mechanisms that made of some proteins in RNA that link it all together and have a little molecular nano assembly line of the sequences that code for amino acids, and it binds the two amino acids together, then it shuffles them to the next one, links it, and then shuffles it to the next one, links it, and that's how the ribosomes make proteins. Proteins are not made in the nucleus. They're made in organelles called ribosomes.
As you were studying this material in your physician school, I am guessing when you started seeing the degree of complication of the system, you had to be mildly amazed by it. And so, did it all happen by accident, randomly? It's an interesting question that's going to recur to some people. And there is that universal law of physics. Take a large enough amount of material interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. You take something as big as the Earth, for instance, which is just a subset of the solar system and a galaxy, but you take something as big as the Earth, I think it's 10 to the 27, or is it 10 to the 29 kilograms of material. You can count the number of molecules of the Earth, a big number. And you wait a billion years, and you let all that material interact in the presence of water, in the presence of carbon, one of the most active molecules in the world that likes combining with all kinds of stuff in complicated ways. And you wait a billion years, and this magic happens. I guess that you were mildly amazed as you started hearing these details. Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
I've kind of always been incredibly amazed with how complicated the universe is on so many different levels. I mean, the mechanism that DNA gets changed to RNA and RNA codes for proteins isn't that difficult to wrap your head around. But if you have nothing better to do someday, take a look at there are biochemistry charts of cell metabolism with just a small percentage of the synthesis of different molecules that goes on every fraction of a second in pretty much every cell of our bodies. That will kind of completely amaze most people, hopefully. It can take up a whole wall, and it's just a small portion of all the things going on every instance to just let you do the most venal things imaginable. Life is amazing. You know, biology is amazing. Science in general has always been amazing to me.
And you're describing what goes on in each and every cell of the, 3 billion cells that we've got in a human being, some big number like that. Each and every cell is doing that. You put it all together. Tremendous amounts of energy is being modified, consumed, oxygenated, what's the word for it? Metabolized. When you're living, you are a 120-watt light bulb. You're making 120 watts of heat. 2,500 kilocalories per day of energy is consumed to do all of those zillions of functions to keep you alive. That 120 watts and 2,500 calories never gets turned off, not for a second. It runs continuously. Some portion of your body, add it all together, you're continuously dissipating that. You're giving off that amount of heat because of the metabolism that's going on. A continuous supply of oxygen and nutrients are required to maintain that. You can only do without air for 3 minutes before you die. You can do without water for roughly 3 days before you die. You can do without food for roughly a month before you die. But you've got to have this continuous supply of raw materials to sustain that, let me call it a great big process, a zero reaction. 120 watts. 450 BTUs per hour. Each human being sitting in that theater is giving off 120 watts. 450 BTUs of heat is being given off by that human being sitting in that theater. If you didn't design the air conditioning to be able to take care of those 300 people in that theater, boy, they're going to be uncomfortable. How are you, Roy? K2RIW.
Well, for a long, long time now, I've kind of conceived as the basic concept of life to be one of the strangest Byzantine ways for the second law of thermodynamics to follow the path. It is a very circuitous route to increasing entropy. The second rule of thermodynamics doesn't say that everything has to be disorderly. It says that the total disorder in a system has to increase. And anyone who's seen people in action know that people can create a great deal of disorder. So no matter how highly ordered we are to live, we have a net increase in the entropy to the universe that drives us forward. And unfortunately, animals didn't make it all the time. There have probably been hundreds of millions of different species of animal that just kind of flickered and faded out for different reasons. They don't like the dinosaurs and such. So I find life incredibly amazing. Some people find it as their proof that God exists. Others don't believe that that's the answer to that problem. You have always problems of infinite regression. If you keep going back in time, it gets confusing no matter who you believe in. If you believe in the Big Bang, well, what caused that and what was before the Big Bang? If you believe in God, then the question is, well, who created God? So you're always stuck with that infinite regression problem.
Doesn't sound like we're going to figure it all out in the near future, does it, Roy?
No, I think not. We'll have to wait after the political net at 12:07. Maybe we can set up the philosophy net at something like 2:30 in the morning.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
Yeah, as I understand it, and I can't pronounce them, so I'll just call them GATNC. The chemicals mate or link with each other. I think G only links with A and T with C. You can almost represent this in a binary 1-0 notation. My question is there any kind of parity check or error check in these coding of these four chemicals as they link?
Well, I kind of would disagree with you that it's binary, because you could either have a position be adenine, thymine, guanine, or cytosine. So it's really not a base 2 numbering system. It's more of a base 4 numbering system. And adenosine binds with thymine, guanine binds with cytosine. And the way that life has decided to figure this all out is to then use triplets of these four bases. So say you have something that's adenine, and adenine, AA and A. That codes for a certain protein when it gets to the ribosomes. Unfortunately, it would be nice if there was error correction, and there might be some form that we're not familiar with yet. There are ways of recognizing damage to DNA and repairs that sometimes work and sometimes don't, but it doesn't really work to kind of imagine it as the binary error correction of computers, at least not yet. Yes, Lou.
Yeah, so those are called codons, I believe. That's the triples. And, like, for example, I believe there's a stop codon. It's stopping coding. A certain sequence says, okay, we're done.
Yeah, you need an off switch.
All right, that was it.
Okay, it's all rather fascinating. There are nuances as time has gone on. What sometimes happens is there are mechanisms in cells where they stick methyl groups on the DNA, and depending upon where it is and what's going on, the methyl groups could shut down that gene sequence. So there's all kinds of feedback mechanisms that we're just teasing out. Unfortunately, science often is like onions, layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. But to me, again, it's fascinating that the underlying mechanism for the blueprints and protein production in a human being is, for all intents and purposes, identical to a fungus or to a persimmon. Yes, Lou.
Yeah, so these methyl groups, like you say, they act as switches to turn certain genes on to express, turn them off, and they can be affected by environment and also through generations. Examples of if an ancestor, maybe a grandfather or something, went through a famine, that'll affect the epigenome, if you will. One layer outside the genome, using this mechanism of methylation, turning on and off genes.
Right you are, Lou. I mean, one of the oldest scientific debates are whether things are the way they are because of nature or because of nurture. And the unfortunate reality is the most likely answer is yes. Not one, not the other, but both. And that's annoying to people. They would rather have nice, clean answers. But you're quite right that there are environmental factors that can put a permanent imprint in the expression of genetic material and change the descendants that way. It doesn't have to be a pure mutation. It could be a series of other things that happens within the nucleus of the cell to permanently switch something off that was once on. Anyone have any further questions on this subject or any questions before I start the usual stories?
Yes, good evening, Roy, KD2NXJ. What was the answer to your original question?
Hello, Sam. The answer to the question was that all living things contain DNA. Viruses can either contain DNA or RNA, but if it's living by the general criteria that everyone gives for living organisms, it must have DNA because that's the underlying pretty much universal mechanism to express all the blueprint information on how to produce all the proteins and chemicals that make life possible.
Thank you, Roy. Beautiful question. I was trying to read while you were talking. It's too much stuff. Oh, my God. I mean, they got big words. I have to look up each word. But you're good, Roy. Thank you very much. KD2NXJ.
Well, you're welcome, Sam. It can be a little confusing. Some of these words are very big. And again, if you have nothing better to do someday, just Google, I guess it would be biochemistry chart. And it is basically a lot of different names of things with arrows in what direction it gets built from precursors to different things. There's a lovely there's a lovely chemical reaction that I always loved called the carnitine shuttle because it uses a molecule called carnitine and it someone liked the name of shuttling it, so it's the carnitine shuttle, and it just gives you just the slightest hint of the incredibly complicated things going on in each and every cell of our body and the body of every living thing. So, you know, life is probably a lot more amazing than we even perceive it to be.
Okay, thank you, Roy. And it's very scary. I'm clear.
Okay, Sam, you're always welcome to ask questions or make comments or what have you. Glad to have you aboard. Anyone else with any questions or comments before I move on to the next story? Okay, very well. Richie talked about all the planets lining up in something that approaches a straight line. That's called alignment. Due to the orientation and the tilt of the orbits of all the planets, it can't actually line up straight. But it can come as close as... But it came as close as it could get around 949 AD, and the next time that will happen will be May 6, 2492. So everybody that's terribly optimistic, put it on your calendar to remember. When two heavenly bodies line up, we call that a conjunction. Now, as Harry KC2 FYJ mentioned last week, three objects in alignment is called a syzygy. Harry also mentioned a recent report from this July about a paper showing a strong correlation with the alignment of Earth, Venus, and Jupiter. A a alignment that occurs every 11.2 years, and our own cross to bear the 11-year sunspot cycle. And Lou NY2H out there was kind enough to send me a link to a web article on that paper. That's what I find most satisfying about science talk, by the way, when discussion can bring together new bits of data and new proposed theories. Now, for more than 1,000 years, the number of sunspots hit a minimum within a few years of a major planetary alignment. A recent study showed that tides